Welcome to Word of Mouth News for this Friday, August the 13th, Friday the 13th. My name is Susie Alvarez, and we're waiting for my co-host, Kristen Schwartz, to arrive at the station and join us. But at this point, I'm just going to give you a quick rundown of what we're going to be bringing to you tonight. First, we're going to start off with headlines. Then hopefully this time around, we will be successful to make connection with Dar Jamil, who's an award-winning independent journalist who has also been recently reporting from the Gulf Coast. He is there at this point and is hoping to join us and give us a report from the ground and let us know what is happening in the Gulf region in the aftermath of the spill. So we will be crossing fingers that this interview will actually happen this time around. And then at 6:30, we will turn the mic over to Anti-Psychiatry Radio and OCAP Radio is a special collaboration for this month of August. Don White will not be in the studio, but we will be sharing with you a pre-recorded interview with OCAP activist Gitan Heru. So let's get to the headlines so that we can spend some quality time with Dar Jamil when he joins us over the phone from the Gulf. We begin with headlines that come to us thanks in part to Democracy Now!, Rabble, and the CBC, as well as Al Jazeera English. On financial corruption news, amidst some of the worst economic updates in weeks, a new report predicts Wall Street bonuses will likely increase for the second straight year. The compensation consultant Johnson Associates says firms will see bonus hikes of up to 15%, surpassing 2009 levels. And in the U.S., oil giant BP has been fined $50.6 million for ongoing safety hazards stemming from a deadly 2005 explosion that killed 15 workers and injured 180 others at its Texas City, Texas refinery. The penalty comes on top of an $87 million fine against BP last year for failing to make safety improvements. Earlier this year, the refinery accidentally released an estimated 538,000 pounds of toxic chemicals over the course of 40 days. And in Alabama, the state's attorney general has filed two lawsuits accusing BP and other companies of neglecting their responsibility for the Gulf Coast oil disaster. The separate lawsuits allege that BP, as well as other firms including Transocean and Halliburton, have damaged Alabama's economy and environment through quote-unquote negligent or wanton failure to adhere to recognized industry standards. The suits seek unspecified economic and punitive damages. Over 300 federal lawsuits have been filed in 12 states against BP and the other main companies involved in the disaster. Meanwhile, here in Canada, the Pembina Institute says Imperial Oil is being allowed to break rules about tailings for its new Kearl oil sands plant. Alberta's Energy Resources Conservation Board gave Imperial Oil conditional approval of its plan to deal with tailings at the plant north of Fort McMurray, which will start operating in 2012. Imperial said it wouldn't be able to meet new targets for turning toxic liquid tailings into more manageable solid waste for the first 6 years of operation at this plant because it needs time to work on new technology. The Conservation Board ordered Imperial to submit a new plan by 2012 outlining how it can speed up tailings reduction and to go above and beyond requirements after 2018 to make up for its slow start. Simon Dyer, Oil Sands Program Director for the Pembina Institute, an environmental think tank, said the permission to go ahead without meeting requirements amounts to allowing Imperial to break the rules. And in immigration news, the U.S. Congress has given final approval to a $600 million measure to increase militarization of the U.S.-Mexico border. The Senate approved the measure with just two members present who chose to interrupt their summer recess to advance the bill over a congressional procedure held it up after a congressional procedure held it up. Supporters of the measure believe it will help in the fight against violence and drug trafficking along the border. The spending will fund around 1,500 new border agents and law enforcement officials, as well as two aerial surveillance drones. The bill now goes to President Obama, who is expected to sign it into a law. And the vote comes on the heels of a poll carried out this week showing the majority of residents in U.S. towns bordering Mexico feel their communities are safe. The group that commissioned the poll, the Border Network for Human Rights, says it's the first independent survey of border town residents. Over 86% of respondents said they feel safe in their daily activities, and nearly 70% said they feel they're as safe as in any community in the United States. In a statement, Fernando Garcia of the Border Network for Human Rights said, quote, "It is time to rethink our border policy by increasing the quality and accountability of border enforcement, not the quantity of armed agents and soldiers," unquote. While in Canada, the Navy intercepted a ship carrying nearly 500 Tamil refugees in British Columbia. The ship's passengers are hoping to stay in Canada after fleeing Sri Lanka, which ended a nearly three-decade civil war last year. Vic Toews, Canada's public safety minister, called some of the passengers, quote, "suspected human smugglers and terrorists," unquote. No One Is Illegal recently released an urgent call to the Canadian government to accept the Tamil refugees, stating, quote, "they've survived a long and arduous journey in the hopes that the Canadian state will fully comply with its international obligations to the right to asylum," unquote. And in news from the Middle East, Israel has rejected a new Palestinian offer to base peace talks on establishing a Palestinian state along the 1967 borders. The proposal was based on a statement released earlier this year by the Middle East Quartet, which comprises representatives from the U.S., the U.N., the European Union, and Russia. The statement also called for a freeze on West Bank settlements and on home demolitions in East Jerusalem. But Israel has refused to accept any preconditions that could scale back its control of the West Bank. And in Pakistan, officials are warning the province of Sindh is facing floods that could be as destructive as the first round that displaced millions of people. Rising waters in nearby river could overrun the surrounding embankments and flood the area. More than 1,600 people have died since the floods began over 2 weeks ago. And in Burma, the country's military junta has announced it will hold the country's first elections in two decades on November 7th. The main Burmese opposition party, the National League for Democracy, has already said it will boycott the elections because the junta has barred the pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi and all other current and former political prisoners from running. Then we go to the Caribbean, where in Haiti, dozens of protesters held a sit-in at the National Palace yesterday to oppose the forced evictions of thousands of displaced residents from makeshift camps. The Haitian government has been urged to issue a moratorium on all forced evictions until alternative shelter options can be provided. And in prisoners' justice news, the trial of Omar Khadr, Guantanamo-based youngest detainee and a Canadian citizen, has been suspended indefinitely after his lawyer collapsed in the courtroom. Army Lieutenant Colonel John Jackson, who is Khadr's military lawyer, was being flown back to the United States for treatment today after he fainted on the first day of testimony a day earlier. Jackson, Khadr's only lawyer, is to be treated for complications from a recent gallbladder surgery. The trial will not resume until Jackson is medically cleared. Before Jackson fainted, the proceedings on Thursday focused on the information Khadr had told interrogators. Khadr had confessed to being a member of al-Qaeda and described pulling the pin of a grenade that killed a U.S. soldier in Afghanistan. But Jackson said Khadr's words were those of a scared child who was frightened into giving a false confession after hearing made-up tales of a young boy gang rape in prison. And this past Tuesday, August 10th, marked the 35th anniversary of Prisoners' Justice Day in Canada. Families, allies, and community groups gather in various cities and spaces to hold vigils and events in solidarity and in protest against, quote, all deaths in custody, the inhumane use of solitary confinement, racist policing, the detention and deportation of immigrants and refugees, the taking of land through colonization and the criminalization of First Nations defense of their territories, the denial of justice for Aboriginal women and trans people, the destructive effects of prison, poverty, and homelessness, the separation of families, security certificates, tasers for prison guards and cops, the over-incarceration for people who use drugs or are involved in sex work, the over-incarceration of people living with disabilities, especially people with mental health issues and learning disabilities, and the medical neglect of prisoners with HIV/AIDS and the lack of harm reduction in prisons, unquote. Here in Toronto, a vigil was held outside the Don Jail on Tuesday evening, where many grassroots organizations spoke out against our country's skewed criminal justice system, its prison industrial complex, and the conservative government's decision to budget $9 billion for building new prisons when crime rates are going down. And in honor of Prisoners' Justice Day, we leave you with a song, the song many of you know, Amazing Grace, sang by British grandmother Linda Carty, who was wrongfully sentenced to death by a Texan court and is now dangerously close to execution. For more information on how to help save Linda and join the struggle to use the law to enforce the human rights of prisoners from death row to Guantanamo Bay, we encourage you to visit www.reprieve.org.uk. So here is Linda Carty.
Amazing grace.
I don't believe in the death penalty, and I don't think you should kill anyone. But if I have to die, I pray that my family and my mom, especially my daughter, will not look and not feel ashamed of their daughter or their mother because I was guilty, but realize that the state of Texas has failed me in that. From day one, I was given an attorney that did nothing, didn't even bother to come to visit me or to find out the facts. He didn't even try to prove my innocence.
I was blind, oh, but now I see. Was grace that taught my heart to fear, and grace my fears relieved. How precious did that grace.
Transmisión Radio Fides, La Paz, Bolivia.
Ven acá, queridita mía. Oye, mi negra, lo que te vengo a decir. Tengo mucho tiempo y hace muchos días. Te estaré enamorado, no te puedo conseguir.
Inflamación de la garganta.
Lo que te vengo a explicar, tengo largo tiempo de estar enamorado. No sé por qué motivo no me quieres aceptar.
Para esta son.
Ven acá, mi amor, que te voy a explicar una cosa. Ahí mismo nomás, ¿no?
Dios de la garganta.
Listening to CKLN 88.1 FM. This is your word of mouth news for Friday, August the 13th. And it seems that we're having some bad luck today because we have not been able to get Dr. Mile on the phone. So we are going to go instead to an interview with Norman Girvan, who's an author and professor at the University of the West Indies in St. Augustine, Trinidad and Tobago. He speaks critically on the European Union's economic partnership agreement with the Caribbean countries known as the CARIFORUM, an agreement which was pushed by the EU trade negotiators after the dissolution of the WTO negotiations in Cancun, Mexico. In this interview, Girvan offers perspectives on the relationship between current European trade policy in the Caribbean and the European legacy of colonization in the region, offering perspectives on the colonial echoes seen today in European trade policy in the Caribbean. And of course, this should be of interest to Canadians as well, because the European Union is pushing for a free trade agreement with Canada as well, which could have very large-scale impacts that have nothing to do with trade and everything to do with corporations getting their way. So we're going to go to that interview. This was conducted by Stefan Christoph at CKUT in Montreal.
You are listening to Fighting FTAs. Bilaterals.org presents a contemporary audio review on the international state of free trade policy. focusing on regional and bilateral trade accords and their impacts on the environment, people, and economies around the world. I am Stefan Christoph. In this feature interview, we will hear from Norman Gervan, author and professor at the University of the West Indies in St. Augustine, Trinidad and Tobago, who speaks critically on the EU-driven economic partnership agreement with Caribbean countries, known as CARIFORM, an agreement pushed by European Union trade negotiators after the dissolution of the World Trade Organization negotiations in Cancun, Mexico in 2003. In this interview, Gervan offers perspectives on the relationship between current European trade policy in the Caribbean and the European legacy of colonization in the region, offering perspectives on ties between contemporary European economic policy in the Caribbean and colonial periods in the past. We will now go to our feature interview with Norman Gervan. First, if you could just introduce yourself and speak about why you find it important, let's say on the ground in the Caribbean, to look at the advent of bilateral or regional accords. Obviously around the world there was huge discussion around the WTO. Yeah. And its implications for working people, peasants throughout the global south. With bilaterals, it's become that there's specific implications for different regions, different dynamics, different histories. The European Union has been specifically pushing in the Caribbean. So maybe if you could introduce yourself and talk about why this issue has been important for you.
Yeah. Okay, I'm Norman Gervan, and I'm a professorial fellow at the Institute of International Relations at the University of the West Indies in Trinidad. And just about 3 years ago, the process of concluding the negotiations between the countries of the Caribbean Community, CARICOM, and the Dominican Republic grouped together in the CARI Forum configuration, the process of concluding these negotiations entered their final stage. Uh-huh. I had been working on the subject of regional integration, and I had not been following nor knew very much about the course of the negotiations. Uh-huh. However, when I and several of my colleagues discovered the full scope of this agreement, we became very alarmed because, you know, I think there is a misunderstanding which is portrayed by the use of free trade. These are trade agreements. Yeah. Or even in the case of the EPA, they're called economic partnership agreements. Mm-hmm. But I think they're misleading because they're really agreements which encapsulate virtually all aspects of development. Mm-hmm. And you ask why it's important to me, because I think that what these agreements do is to steer your development of your country, of your economy, into a particular direction. Okay. They make it much more difficult for countries that do not already have well-developed manufacturing and industries and a well-developed food economy. They make it much more difficult for that to develop. In fact, I would say for a small developing country, it virtually excludes the possibility of developing a vibrant manufacturing sector and food sector. What it does do is privilege the developments in manufacturing or in agriculture and in raw materials in the direction of producing raw or semi-processed commodities for export or trying to attract multinational corporations to carry out some parts of their operations in the country utilizing cheap labor. Utilizing cheap labor. So to get into a portion of the of the commodity supply chain or value chain, mm-hmm. which is labor intensive, and in which cheap labor can be used as international competitive advantage, so to speak. But that really steers your development in the direction uh-huh. of producing primary or semi-processed commodities, mm-hmm. the low end of the value chain, so to speak, or those aspects using cheap labor, mm-hmm. and they make it very difficult for you to develop a domestic manufacturing industry mm-hmm. aimed at the domestic and at regional markets, and also a vibrant food mm-hmm. economy, because you're required to reduce or eliminate tariffs on the vast majority of imports mm-hmm. from the European Union. Mm-hmm. In addition to that, because these agreements go beyond mm-hmm. trade in goods, mm-hmm. they include services, mm-hmm. and services include a thing called commercial presence. So by calling services trade, mm-hmm. and then by including services within the scope of the agreement, it really is a backdoor way of getting in foreign investment under highly favorable conditions for the investor, okay. under conditions that guarantee that they are to be treated as if they are domestic investors, that prohibit the use by the local government of things like local quota mm-hmm. requirements, local input quota requirements, that prevent subsidies or incentives being granted to local firms that are not also granted to foreign firms. Uh-huh. So again, it makes it much more difficult or impossible to develop a domestic entrepreneurial class. If you already have a well-developed and vibrant entrepreneurial class that can take advantage of export opportunities in the European market, then there are trade-offs between the access that you give and the access that you get, and there is some hope that there would be an equitable sharing of the benefits. Now, that applies when the two partners are, if not exactly equal levels of development, mm-hmm. are not that dissimilar mm-hmm. levels of development. Mm-hmm. I guess what I'm saying here is that when Brazil negotiates with the EU, the possibilities of getting a favorable outcome for Brazilian exporters and manufacturers are weighed against the access that they give. But when Jamaica or Barbados or Haiti negotiates with the EU, it's a completely different ballgame. You know, these are countries of 1 million, 2 million, Haiti 8 million, with a very, very weak productive sector. The smallest country in the Caribbean community has a population of 50,000. And the populations range between 2 million and about the 50,000. Mm-hmm. So that's why when I and many of my colleagues became aware of the full scope of the agreement that was about to be concluded, mm-hmm. as well as the details, we became very alarmed, because we felt that by entering into this arrangement, we would be, in effect, preempting the development of goods and services industries and the development of national enterprises, local entrepreneurship for our own regional market.
Mm-hmm. So let's just look at some examples. The world has focused on Haiti, of course, since the earthquake in January. Before the earthquake, Haiti was struggling after the coup in 2004 to solidify a vibrant local industrial sector. It's a long struggle, even dating way before that. I'm just interested, so tangibly speaking, maybe if you could give us a picture on why the European Union would find the types of trade agreements it is negotiating in the Caribbean beneficial, and why would and how would that impact efforts to develop a local national industrial sector? It could be Haiti or Barbados, Trinidad.
Yeah. But first of all, I think in the case of the European Union, we have to take account of the fact that there is a global strategy mm-hmm. by the European Union into which the Caribbean is fitted, People say that we have exaggerated the dangers because the Caribbean market is a very small one, and it is in terms of European exports. That's true. But there are strategic objectives that the European Union has, and this has been put into the Global Europe Strategy.
Yes.
And that policy document, and that strategy is to open up the markets of emerging economies to exports of goods and services and investment, and to get also to get access to the resources and raw materials of these countries. So that the Caribbean negotiation was part of a much bigger game to the Europeans, and it was important for them to be able to point to an agreement of this kind being reached with the Caribbean for their negotiations with Africa, which is with which they were also simultaneously negotiating, and which are also members of the African Caribbean Pacific group. So it's as if you have a global strategy. You pick off the weakest countries first, and then you use the agreement with the weakest country to negotiate with the next in line, so to speak. But each one becomes a precedent, which forms the basis for the bigger prize.
Hello, this is Mark Brill, part of the Friday Word of Mouth team. Today will be a fill-in for Don White's and his anti-psychiatry show. Don is taking a break for the month of August. We're thus bringing you a special guest, Gaëtan Heureux, who will provide us with, I think, very timely, in light of the G20 repression and the current economic crisis, history of resistance by the unemployed in the face of repression in Toronto before and during the Great Depression. So I'll hand it over to Gaëtan.
Yeah, hi, Mark. Over the next 20-25 minutes, we're going to go back and look at the history of the unemployed in Toronto, almost dating back about 1895 to just before the Second World War. And we're just going to touch on a few stories because there's actually a long history in our neighborhood in East Downtown Toronto of the unemployed organizing. And what I'm going to try and do is take people here through some of that period and stuff in terms of some of the issues that people were fighting around. Before I start, I just have to set the stage here. One of the most important agencies in the area at the time was called the House of Industry, which is the Toronto's first poorhouse. It was built in 1837, was in our area for about 10 years, and then moved over to the ward in 1847. And one of the things they did in 1895 is they introduced a work test, which was they made the men crack stone or break stone in order to get their relief. They had a work test before that, but they felt that wasn't enough of a deterrent, so they decided to do that. And they argued that this was a great way to deter, in particular, the unemployed, but also married men from applying for relief. What happened is, as a result of that, there was actually resistance to this new work test. And what I'm going to read right now is a letter that appeared in the Star on February 15th, 1909. It's signed out of work, so an unemployed man who wrote a letter to the Star after the Star had done a piece on the labor test. The letter is quite interesting. It gives you a really good sense of how the house industry worked and what the unemployed might have felt around the work test. So here we go. The letter reads, "The city claims to be so very religious. You have a savage way of treating poor fellows that have nowhere to go. The statement that some of the men refuse to work has appeared in the whole of the Canadian press from the Atlantic to the Pacific. But nobody ever asks why such a large percentage of the men refuse to work. No, they are simply put down as lazy. Now, when a man goes to a place like the House of Industry, it is plain that he is half-starved already. There he gets bread and some warm water, called tea, at night and in the morning. Most likely he will not get a bed the first three nights, but will sleep on the floor, with hardly any room to turn. When he gets up in the morning, after what little sleep he had been able to get, he is required to break a lot of stones. The quantity of stones to be broken will take a man used to it 3 hours, but a man not used to that kind of work will take from 4 to 6 hours. 6 hours hard work for a little bit of bread, and the rest of the floor, and we sing Britons Never Shall Be Slaves. Let the people of Toronto reflect a little on the conditions in this city and cease casting slurs upon those who are, for the time being, in bad circumstances. The letter is fascinating because it actually talks about the conditions of the House of Industry, and it's clear that there's objection to this work test in terms of how cruel it is, in terms of making men, as he says, who are already half-starved, break stone for the food. So there's objection to that. So you can find throughout that period people who are actually organizing against the work test. On February 5th, 1915, there's another article that appeared in the section, the court section. It's the story of George Buss, unemployed man, 35 years old, who refused to break stone at the House of Industry. And as a result, he found himself in front of a magistrate. And this is the interaction between George Buss and the magistrate at the time. The story begins, Constable McBurney stated in prosecution that Buss had been getting his meals free at the House of Industry and had refused to work for them. That is crack stone. That is correct, Buss said with a defiant air. Oh, I see. You are one of those who has come to the conclusion that somebody has to support you, said Squire Ellis. Oh, yes, said Buss, who had a sullen expression on his face. Did you refuse to crack stone for your meals? Yes, and there's lots like me. And do you sleep at the police stations? Yes, with hundreds of others. Have you hunted for work? I certainly have. Yet you refuse to work for food, continued the squire. That's one way of looking at it, your way. Well, I think you need looking after, said the worship. It'll be $20 or 90 days in jail. And what's fascinating here is here you have an unemployed man who is in front of a judge who's about to go to jail, who's very confrontational in terms of his attitude. But more importantly, he's actually telling you that he's not alone, that there are many like him who feel this way. There's a kind of consciousness there in terms of the situation that they find themselves in terms of the fact that if they don't have work, that the state owes them relief and that it's not a situation where they're lazy and don't want to work. They literally want to work. So the story is very fascinating in terms of that. So one of the fights, one of the big fights that was going on during this period, again, was around the work test. The unemployed were all the way from 1895, actually all the way up to before the Second World War. And by 1925, the unemployed were actually calling for an end to the work test. But the other big fight that was happening was a fight for free speech in the city. And it came to a head on August 13th, 1929. Prior to that, the communists were trying to organize in the city. They were having problems getting a hold of halls and that kind of stuff. So they organized on street corners, like Queen and Spadina, Dundas and Spadina was the main drag where they used to go. That was Tim Buck and some of the others that were around back then. And often they were chased out the corner, and sometimes they were like brutally beaten back. But what happened October 13th, 1929, is about 5,000 people gathered, and they tried to enter Queen's Park. There was a big gazebo there, and they were going to try and speak in the gazebo. The minute the leaders began to make their move towards the gazebo, there was a police riot, essentially. And the police, for the next few hours, actually beat back many of the demonstrators over there. Not just the demonstrators, but also people who just happened to be in the area.
And that sounds familiar.
It does sound familiar. And this is someone who was there, actually. After that night, actually, a lot of people went back to some of the labor temple and actually talked about what had happened. And this is one of the comments that was made about what happened that night. This is Thomas Leader talking. He says, "Gentlemen, I have just come from a slaughter." This is Tom Leader as he addressed a meeting at the Elscourt Labor Party after the Queen's Park riot. "It was the most brutal, inhumane sample of official violence and the most sordid exhibition of police methods ever heard of. It was unthinkable, awful. I had not dreamed that such things could go on in Toronto." They really, really, literally beat the crap out of people. And actually, some of the newspaper, the Star or the Daily Star at the time, were actually very, very critical of the police in terms of that night. Some of the others not as critical. So the question you want to ask is why this amount of repression? Why, what was the city so scared of? Why were the cops used to repress this large gathering. And by the way, they actually again a week later decided to have to meet again to try to go to Queen's Park. Another 5,000 people actually came. This time they didn't try and enter the park and just walk south instead of going to Queen's Park. But in order to understand what was going on there, there's a person, the police commissioner was Judge Coatsworth, who was a very anti-red person. And he gives you an understanding of what was going on back then in the city in terms of why this stuff was going on. The city had a great, great fear that the unemployed were being organized inside and they were being incited by the communists. Now, you have to understand this incident actually happened just a few months before the great crash, right, the 1929.
Yeah.
So a lot was going on before then. Unemployment was high. And this is what Judge Coatsworth had to say. He says, in Toronto, the capital of the province, they, the communists, are endeavoring in every way to spread their evil doctrines. The communists are not just a mere handful of propagandists to be ignored, but a real menace to be put down with the strongest action possible. These people are foreigners who have left their own countries and have come to seek to abolish existing institutions. Those who think that this is simply an agitation for free speech are entirely mistaken. Speaking for myself, I intend to do everything possible to combat this dangerous element. They already have a serious foothold in Toronto and are trying to establish themselves in other cities. So there was a great fear in the city that you have to understand that the Toronto for a long time it always attracted large number of unemployed. And actually, even as far back as the 1890s, Toronto was described as the headquarters of vagrants and tramps who used to come to the city during winter because they had no work for that kind of stuff. So it has that long history. Except here now you have a situation in 1929, summer 1929, where the hostels are packed. There are thousands of men who have no work, and they're being organized. And that was the threat. And for them, for the police and the city, they knew that they had to get rid of these people. They had to squash this, and the whole fight for free speech, which I won't talk about later on, but it actually resurfaced again in Allen Gardens in the summer of 1933, where I think it was 2,000 ex-soldiers actually organized in Allen Gardens, tried to meet, had a banner that said "Heroes 1914, Bums 1933." And there was a big, big battle that happened for two, three hours. They were chased out. Except for the next month, they vowed to come back, and eventually they broke the back of the city, and the city was forced to allow, people to go to gather in parks and to talk about what was going on, unemployment and stuff.
The numbers are incredible. Thousands of people, 2,000, 5,000 people.
No. Back then, the it was clear that, I mean, if I, it's funny because having organized you and I in the area now for the last, 20 years or so, when we try and work with people in the hostels and stuff, we've been able, in terms of like large demonstrations, Queen's Park, 1,500, sometimes 2,000. But back then, they were able to do that quite regularly in terms of sometimes as many as 5,000. So there's a pretty large movement.
Yeah.
And it's also clear from what we'll see a bit later that they were well organized in terms of the kinds of things they did. So the next thing we'll talk about briefly is the other issue. So we had the issue of the work test, which is the breaking stone, and people organizing around that. We had the whole issue of free speech that was going on. The other issue was around hostile conditions. There was a lot of work being done by the unemployed around hostile conditions, because at the time they were not able to get money to rent a room. And actually, one of their demands actually began that they wanted like $5 a week to be able to rent a room rather than to be in hostels. So that was one of the demands that they had. But also the hostel conditions were horrific. And again, if you begin to look at why were they so horrific, why was the overcrowding so bad, and why was the city allowing to do this, there's a really, really interesting, there's a number of interesting things that happened. One of the guys that was organizing was October 1932, was a guy named William McKnight, an Irishman, who's actually organizing in the hostels, soup kitchens and stuff. He attended a meeting in October 1932 at a Church of the Ascension, and it was said there was about 350 men from Wellington House, which was one of the largest hostels in Toronto, Seton House, and some of the other city hostels. So over 350 people from hostels is a large meeting. to come. Also at the meeting was this counselor, Alderman Rogers. Now, what happens is Willie McKnight was one of the main organizers. He eventually got arrested and the city attempted to deport him as a result of his organizing in shelters and stuff. He's organizing around the food and that kind of stuff. But what's interesting is that night, I think he was arrested by the police, and on him he had a petition. And then when he was arrested, he was questioned by the police, and he said that at one point that he talked about Alderman Rogers, said that he was there at the meeting, and that Alderman Rogers was supposed to bring this petition to the Board of Controls, which is City Hall. Now, what was interesting is when other councillors found out about this, there was a fascinating discussion that happened at City Hall, and the other councillors actually went after this Alderman Rogers. So I'll just read you a little bit of that interaction between the councillors in terms of this petition at McKnight and this meeting at the Church of Ascension, because, again, there was a great fear by the city that these men were meeting, that they were being agitated by various people. And here's what was said. It says, I think Mr. Laver should be given instruction not to allow anyone. Now, I should start before. Mr. Laver was the commissioner, the welfare commissioner at the time, and very important person around that time. He says, so this is the mayor talking. He says, I think Mr. Laver should be given instruction not to allow anyone to go in and talk to men unless they have a permit from him, said Mayor Stewart. They are liable to cause trouble. Controller McBride. They certainly shouldn't be speaking in these institutions. All they want is to be amused. And then Controller Ramadan, another controller, says, could you ever conceive what one riot would mean, more than all we have spent? The mayor, I've done my duty in warning members of council. Councilor McBride, it is unfortunate that in everything that comes up, your friend Rogers is connected with this. And then this is the police speaking. It says, from our investigation, we find that there were no known communists attending the meeting, but a number of socialists were included. And then Mann and Simpson, these were police officers who investigated the issue, they were actually from the Red Squad. And then Alderman Rogers, this is the guy who was at the meeting, says, in fairness to myself, I don't want to go out to the public that I was fomenting discontent. And then Controller McBride said, if you take an old campaigner's advice, you'll keep away from such meetings. So here you have a situation where you have a city politician who is at this meeting. And now other councillors are trying to say, listen, what were you there, inciting these men? Don't you understand that this is dangerous? This is dangerous stuff to do? And the councillor having to back off a little bit, saying, you know, well, it really wasn't really my idea to go there and incite people and stuff, and trying to back off. So it's actually fascinating to see. One is that the men were organizing, but two, this great fear, that somehow by being at these meetings that the men are being incited, and that there was a great fear of riot, that this incitement would lead to riot. And assumingly because the conditions were so bad. We're talking here 1932, at the height of the Depression, which was summer of 1933, almost 30% of the people in Canada were unemployed. Many of those were in large urban centers like Toronto, Vancouver, and other places like that.
Many great ones through the ages have attained to earthly power, yet they all have their hour, as we witnessed behind our cages. Sad it is when fate has failed to speed them, but for us whose job it is to feed them, whether this one's high or that one low, the load on our shoulders always go. Still the mill wheel turns, it turns forever, though what is uppermost remains not so. The water underneath in vain endeavor does the work, but always stays below. Many are different masters who have ruled us in the day. Eagles, hyenas and tigers, even swine have had the say. Which of them was better than the other? Every boot's the copy of its brother. Do you understand what's here intended? We don't need no masters, we want all mastery ended. Still the mill wheel turns, it turns forever. Though what is uppermost remains not so. The water underneath in vain endeavor does the work, but always stays below. And they beat their heads till they are bloody, scrambling after booty. Everyone calls the other rascal and himself the slave of duty. Time has come away to speed them, each in lasting conflict with its brother. Only our will that we won't feed them brings them to peace with one another. Still the mill wheel turns, it turns forever. Though what is uppermost remains not so. The water wound in vain endeavor does the work, but always stays below.
The next story is from, again, that period, 1933. In July 1933, there was an article page of the Toronto Star, and it was about the Crawford shelter. A lot of the men who were saying they were actually ex-soldiers. Now, what's fascinating is as you read the history of the unemployed in Toronto, is that many of the people were actually ex-soldiers from World War One, who actually had no employment, and who were actually organizing in the various communities and stuff. And the conditions in the shelters were there's 320 men that were crammed in the hostel. They slept 42 to a room and were only getting two meals a day. Now, what happened is a delegation of those men actually went again to City Hall and gave a deputation. And what was fascinating here again is you as you'll find out, Commissioner Laver comes up in this thing. And again, Commissioner Laver was very, very important because he became the welfare commissioner and had a lot of power in the city. And actually by 1933, the welfare department had taken over all of the outdoor relief that the House of Industry had been doing for years and years and years. I think at the time in the summer of 1933, 25,000 families were getting relief. So huge enterprise and stuff. So he was a powerful person. So here you have these ex-soldiers who go to the city hall and they want to talk about their conditions. And this is the interaction between the men and Commissioner Laver. He says, delegation, these men complain of poor meals and overcrowding. Perhaps you don't realize that we have to handle these men so that they won't want to come back, said Laver. You mean you don't want to make a sort of home for them, the delegation said. That's it. We don't want to make too comfortable for them. What about getting two meals instead of three? We are following the usual policy, three meals in the winter and two in the summer. What about the treatment in general? No, I'm satisfied that the conditions are all right, said Laver. That they are crowded, 42 to a room, the delegation said. They are large rooms, as large as the school rooms. I don't think it's too much, Laver said. What about the meals? They say that they're rotten, the delegation says. It's not generally known, but the city has not paid 1 cent towards the meals. Of the 1 million or so meals last year, the city taxpayer hasn't paid 1 cent. They come from the private sources. And the quarters, the delegation said, the beds are the same as they had at the Coliseum. Now, the Coliseum was another place that was used to house ex-soldiers. The men have signed a petition, 190 of them, so they say, and sent it to the city council about the conditions at the hostels. Laver, I don't know anything of that. I don't think they have anything to complain about. What we've tried to keep down the number down to less than 300. And in view of the recent complaints, you'll make no investigation of the Crawford hostelry, the delegation asks. No, I'm satisfied that things are as good as they can be under the circumstances. You have troubles with the human sight of relief applicants, the delegation says. We don't want to make it too comfortable for them. And then again, Laver restates that he won't look into the conditions. The headlines in the Daily Star the next day was, "Try not to make the job as comfortable," Laver says. "Handle the man so they won't want to come back." So here again, you have a policy, a very open policy, which is discriminates against this man, that says, if you make it too comfortable for these people to come to the city, they'll come. But if you make it very uncomfortable, we'll drive them out. And it's a fan. Again, it's very fascinating in terms of the interaction between the declaration. They're obviously living in really, really bad conditions. There are many, many, many stories of actually the unemployed organizing around the Wellington House, which by the 1930s was the largest hostel in Toronto. Over 600 men, actually, just not far from in East Downtown Toronto. And also the House of Industry and some others.
Not aware of that one. Wellington House?
Wellington House, yeah. It was first built in 1930. It was run privately for the first year, but then the Welfare Department took it over. And actually a lot of the organizing came out of Wellington House, actually. A lot of the conditions were... I won't talk about them today, yeah. but there's a lot of that stuff that happened. So the other story I have is again, another... William McKnight was one of the men that was organizing in the area. Another man that was organizing actually not far from here, actually used to live on Ontario Street, was an ex-soldier whose name was William Lyons. And actually, William Lyons was involved in the summer of 1933 in the free speech fights. Mm-hmm. Actually, he was actually arrested that day and went to jail for 30 days. And on June 13th, 1934, Lyons, with a delegation of six men who were from the Ward 2 Unemployed Association, went to City Hall. And here, what I want to do is, this will take a little longer, there's a little bit more stuff here. I want to read in terms of the account of what happened that day as recorded by the Star and also from some of the court records. And as you'll see, the resistance was quite intense in terms of it was a very, very militant group. They were ready to fight. And so I'm just going to read some of the stuff, and hopefully this will make sense to people as I read it. So here's how it starts. What is your name? The mayor asked the leader. William Lyons was the answer. And yours? Pursued the mayor. McCab was the answer. Weren't you people told not to come back here? Asked the mayor. No, came a chorus of responses. With this, the leader started to read a speech. On behalf of the Ward 2 unemployed, he began. Just a minute, put the mayor. We're not going to hear you. After much wrangling, the leader again attempted to speak. We're not going to hear you, repeated the mayor. There is the door. Are you a servant of the people or a dictator? Lyons demanded. I am a servant of the people, but I'm not going to listen to you. You are just a bunch of agitators. With this, the police stepped and the struggle ensued. What follows is a description of the struggle. Fists flew in the city council chambers, and for a time the situation looks serious when a deputation of Ward 2 unemployed stubbornly resisted efforts of officers to eject them. One man with an artificial leg seized Sergeant Dickinson by the throat and had him gasping double over the desk. Captain T. Heron, the Civic Welfare Department, came to the rescue and sent his son sprawling on the floor. Before he did so, however, another man had stepped up and smashed Dickinson in the face. Plainclothesman man of the Red Squad got a neck hold on another demonstrator, but had a much more difficult insomnium. The controllers stirred uneasily in their seats. Whole others scampered to safety. The unemployed received cheers and encouragements from the gallery. So you can see
what the scene, right?
Yeah. You can see, and they're very close. I mean, they're right by the table. You know, you can see. And actually, when I read this, it's almost like I don't know if people remember the Axworthy action that happened in Montreal when several hundred people went into and shut down the Axworthy inquiry into reforms to welfare.
Yeah.
And it's a very similar scenes in terms of people coming in, tables being turned over, and chairs, and people in the gallery cheering them and stuff. Yeah. Oh, so I'll leave it. I'll leave. You know what? We'll just see. Yeah. As you look, you know, at some of the history of the unemployed, there are countless, numerous accounts like this of the unemployed going to the City Hall, because at the time, it was City Hall that was responsible for the relief of the unemployed.
So no provincial input.
There were very little provincial money that was coming. I mean, there was always this fight. Yeah. And at times even the funding that was coming from the province and the federal government was totally eliminated. And then, for instance, in 1935, in the summer of 1935, about 1,100 men were actually kicked out of the hostels, just put out in the streets. Actually, it's just the, there would have been hundreds of men just at the corner of Queen and Sherburn here, right around the corner. And at the time, the CCF was actually organized and came in and actually picked up the men. They actually, for two, 3 nights, they put them up in some of the clubs and stuff that was happening.
It's amazing to hear this unknown history. We're pretty much...
Okay. I have time. I'll finish with one.
But if you,
I'll try and finish. So the last thing we'll talk about is so in the spring of 1933, the National Committee of Unemployed Council was organizing across Canada, but also in Toronto. And I'll just end by reading this quote, and hopefully I'll be able to fit on there. And this is from a pamphlet that they put out, and it was cost 5 cents a nickel at the time. And this is the preamble in terms of they had a 10-point program that they were asking for: employment insurance, abolition of work tests, etc. So here we go, and I'll end with this. It says, unemployment, want, and hunger prevails all over this rich country. Tens of thousands of working people, men, women, and children, are suffering and are on the verge of starvation because they lack sufficient food, clothing, and shelter. As the present crisis deepens and becomes more and more acute, more and more toilers are losing their jobs, their meager savings and belongings consequently are needing relief. The huge army of destitute people increased day by day. What is the policy of the Canadian government, federal, provincial, and municipal, to this situation of hunger? It has been still and is that of slow starvation. The workers have been forced to fight for every bit of relief they receive today. For this reason, the relief is better in those parts of the country where the workers organizing have actually struggled for relief, or where the very threat of struggle has compelled the government to grant relief. These forms of actions and struggles have resulted in so much more bread, milk, clothing, self-respect for tens of thousands of unemployed and their dependents. The willingness to struggle, the determination to resist all efforts to be class and treated like outcasts and paupers have brought results of victories, no matter how small. These achievements of the organized unemployed movement have given new courage, new hope, new self-respect, and countless of men and women were plunged onto silent misery, poverty, degradation by terrible forces of hunger. And the kinds of things that they did, and I'll end again with this, the kinds of things, the kinds of tactics that they use, and I'll just go through a list of them, just in terms of how they organize, and they use mass demonstration, hunger marches, relief strikes, picketing of homes and offices of officials, mass delegations at relief offices to defend the rights of individuals being refused relief, surrounding and occupations of homes of workers being evicted, petitions, supporting strikes of employed workers, and holding public hearings and public trials to expose the conditions of the unemployed. So they're very, very active in terms of what they did and the kinds of tactics that they were using.
So many thanks to Gaëtan Heroux for that incredibly interesting piece of history of Toronto resistance. The music, by the way, that we heard in there was by Richard Desjardins, The Ballad of the Mill Wheel. Tune in next week for a word-of-mouth radio on CKLN 88.1, known as Illegal, and OCAP Radio next week. Thanks for listening.